Hello everybody and welcome to another comedian's interview for my blog A Rich Comic Life. My name is Richard Gill and my blog charts my experiences of watching over 750 stand-up comedians and counting over the last 45 years. I'm delighted to welcome today a very special comedian, Mr. TNN Dweeb. Yes! Hello, mate!
Hey, that was lovely. So good. I forgot how many shows comedians you've seen. That is remarkable.
It's extraordinary. Yeah. Absolutely. I forget myself. It originally started off as a book because I put it all in Excel and listed every gig and everything.
And that's amazing. I don't know how you've had time to do anything else.
but I'm transferring all the comedians in the book into the blog. So I reckon by the end of it, there'll be over 1,000, which is incredible.
Oh my goodness.
Goes way back to the 70s.
So, that's amazing.
Anyway,
that's
never mind me. How are you? Are you all right?
Yeah, I'm good. I'm honoured to be one of the thousands that you'll be speaking to.
Well, you're very kind. So am I. I'm absolutely delighted that you're here to do this. The interview's going to last about an hour, and it's going to be all about you, your comedy career, how you got started.
Yeah. I really haven't got a clue. You sent me the questions very nice, and part of it I was going through it going, oh, I don't remember. No, I'm gonna say, I don't remember.
This could be the shortest interview then.
What happens in a lot of these interviews, especially because I've been gigging for a horribly long amount of time now, or up until last March, I was gigging until horribly long, you know, and you just sort of forget, everything blurs into one big, and currently in current time, I just don't remember even what I did yesterday because every day is the same. So,
well, let's give it a go, my friend. let's start off, go right back to the start. How did you become a comedian?
I think it's a boring origin story. So I'm sorry, like some comedians I know have got like amazing ones where they were dared to go on stage or they, you know, ended up doing something. And then, but mine is, I did drama at university, at University of Kent, because I wanted to do acting. I was in like plays from like the age of three. I was always doing school plays and doing theatre schools on weekends. It's all I wanted to do. And then at my university, there was a lecturer called Dr. Oliver Double, and he taught a course in stand-up. And he's amazing. He was the first doctor of comedy in the UK. He had a PhD in comedy, first person ever. And he taught this brilliant course that was, there was one course about comedy and the history of it and also, you know, how it worked and technique. And then he taught a longer course that I took, which was doing stand-up. And I thought it was only one day a week, whereas all the other courses are like 4 days a week, 5 days a week. I was really lazy and thought, yes, one day a week, and then I can go to the last week. but also, I just thought, this is something I've always loved. I loved stand-up since I was a kid, and I always tried to go see stand-ups where I could. And I took this course, and it was quite intensive because like you had to pretty much do 10 minutes of new material every week for 8 weeks. Having never done stand-up before, it was straight away in the student bar. You had 2 weeks to write your first set and perform to your friends and other students. And it was, and Ollie was brilliant at telling you like, this is you and this is your personality. Yeah. Flesh out this, talk about this more. This really suits you when you do this. You really shine when you talk about this. And he was very complimentary, very positive. And it was a really cushy way of starting stand-up. So it was a very safe way. I did that course for about a year, and then I just realized that is the best thing I have ever done and the only thing I ever want to do. And I never want to read anyone else's lines anymore. I want to write all my own material and do that. And I left uni and got a job and started gigging in the evenings, working in the day and gigging every night. And that's that.
That's fantastic. What a great answer. Can you describe your first gig? Did you go through the free comedy clubs where you do 5 minutes and you take a friend along, or how did
I've got two first gigs, because the first gig I did was at my uni, which was a bit of a cheat, really. But I remember being shaking and feeling like I was going to vomit at any second, and being like, lots of people asked me if I was all right, so I was completely pale and sweating. And I remember it was a little student bar in Elliott College, and it was absolutely rammed. And I remember walking up to the stage and all those feelings disappearing with the first laugh. Wow. And it just really like this mad rush. And there was a joke that I told at that I still occasionally tell, which was that Lionel Richie is both rich and looks like a lion. And that joke, it went down really well. And but so that was like gig number one, but that was with friends, so it was supportive, even though I was absolutely terrified. And then the first real one I did was at the Laughing Horse Greenwich. In the Spanish Galleon pub, this funny little upstairs room, and there was only a handful of audience members at best, and I was very nervous. And I remember it was Sean James who was hosting.
Yeah,
he was very lovely.
He was wonderful. Yeah,
lovely, and a really nice like first compere to have, because he was very welcoming and made
very
me feel very comfortable.
As well,
absolutely, he's really lovely with new acts. And I remember a lot of the acts on before me were really bonkers new acts. Like, some of them were straight stand-up. Some of them were just bonkers, somebody trying to get changed out of a suit into a tracksuit while shouting at a CCD case. Or something like really, the stuff that you only see on the open mic circuit where you go, is this comedy? Is this someone having a breakdown? I don't know what it is. And I stood on stage, and I think, I don't really remember what I did, but I remember Sean telling me afterwards that I spoke like a machine gun fire, that I was 100 words a minute, just he could slow down next time.
Yeah, just slow down just a wee bit. We think you're going really well, but
I did. It was good advice. Yeah, very good advice. Yeah. But.
Tell me more about Comedy for Kids, which you've helped set up. How long's that been going now?
Ages. I don't know. So I did sort of help set it up. I co-run it, but it was actually set up by a comedian called James Campbell.
Right.
Who is now a children's author.
Right.
And he set it up originally because he thought it was very unfair that kids like to laugh, but no one does stand up for them. Because he thinks that kids like to laugh even when adults do, and yet they don't get stand up comedy, and that's not fair. So he set up this club where he'd get lots of comedians just from the adult circuit, from the normal circuit, to come and do sets that had no swearing in and were suitable for kids.
Yeah,
and were often very risky at the edge of what was suitable for kids. including Glenn Wool once doing one when he was basically on a come down from the night before and having to lie on the stage and asking if there were any single mums in the house.
Wow. And, good on him for trying.
there you go. He asked me to do it quite early on because he'd seen my normal stand-up and said, you're very kid-friendly anyway. You've got sort of energy that would work, and would I like to try it? And I went along and gave it a go and thought it was brilliant but completely chaotic.
Yeah.
And he then sort of ended up enlisting me to help, and then over time he gave it up to kind of pursue his career as a writer, and I now kind of run it with two others and have been for 14 years.
So it's still going now,
We just did an online gig yesterday for a lovely school called St. Gregory's in Essex.
Brilliant.
With myself and Helen Duff and Jay Thorman. And we did
great. The two really funny people. Yeah. That's brilliant. It's and what you must get out of it, you can see obviously the differences with the different audiences.
Yeah,
it's a different approach.
Is do you know what it's I sort of talk about it as like kind of it sounds a bit wanky, but I think it sort of balances me out, right? Because for adults I'm often going, everything is shit, everything is shit, the world is terrible, it's all going to hell. And then for kids I go, everything is brilliant, this is great, I love this, isn't this bonkers? And I feel like it sort of balances me out that I can do two different styles of writing and two different performances, because I do completely different material for both. And you know, that yesterday for the kids, I was giving them tips on how to annoy their parents. If they've run out of new ways to annoy their parents, they've been at home for so long.
Right.
So I was giving them lots of tips on how to do it. And it's so much fun to just watch kids giggle endlessly. Yeah. You know, there's all these different, you know, different ways in that kids treat being in an audience. So I mean, less so. Obviously, you're a very good, enthusiastic audience member, but there are a lot of adults who go to a comedy show and cross their arms and go, make me laugh. And you've got to prove yourself to them, and you've got to kind of warm them up. Whereas kids are always, it's a show! Yeah. Oh, my God! And they're excited, and they sit in the front row first, and they very rarely heckle to be malicious. They just heckle because they're like, we have to tell you stuff that's in our heads.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it's just a whole different energy, and like, I know it's something we'll talk about later, but like nerves for like adult gigs.
Yeah.
I never ever get nerves for kids gigs because you never feel like you're going to mess it up with it. You know, you always feel like they don't care. They're just in it for the journey and they're going to have a great time with you. And it just feels like a whole different thing. So I love it. I absolutely love doing them. I'm very pleased that they're still going and people still like them. So
a friend of mine who's a comedian now, used to work in, I work in a secondary school, and he once asked me to join in one of the lessons, and I was just like busy working away, and he said, just do exactly what I tell you to do. And on the screen, as I was standing at the door, on the PowerPoint screen, Eddie Edwards was flying down a mountain. And he said, and kids, Eddie Edwards is here now. And I opened the door and took a bow, and all the kids burst out laughing. And I thought, well, that was easy.
That's very funny. That's a good, I mean, also like secondary school kids are the hardest audience in the world. I swear, because they think kids' material is too babyish for them, which it is, because they're older, but they're not old enough for adult gigs because they don't get it. And it's not, you know, a lot of times you get in trouble if you perform adult material. And so they're at this weird age where nothing you can do is good enough.
Please laugh.
There's certain comedians that work brilliantly for teenagers, and I applaud that. I don't know how they do it. I'm petrified.
Well, it is the old adage where a lot of teachers, ex-teachers, are comedians. Because they have to stand up and deliver a lesson as opposed to deliver a routine, you know. So you have my utmost respect for what you do. I've said it many times to other comedians I've talked to. You've got 1 minute when the lights go down to go out in front of a stage and grab that audience, either with your originality or a funny line, or you're very endearing. You know, it's a gift to have. It really is.
But it's a learned gift, though. I think for me, it's learned. Well, you know, I think there's a certain amount. And there are a lot of comedians who do have it. Like, they have it immediately, and I'm really jealous of all of them. What bastards. Absolute bastards. Talented bastards. I hate them. I always like performing. But you learn, like, I learned through, especially through doing awful things like the Gong Show, where you learn you have to do a gag within the first 10 seconds, otherwise you are off. Or, you know, I wouldn't necessarily recommend anyone do that horrible show. It's such a horrible show. But like, it did, you know, you learn like, right, this is how I do it. And actually the weirdest thing was, I found the more I gigged, I used to always think you have to walk out on stage and do, bam, here's a joke, get in, me. And the more and more I gigged, the more I realized, actually, you walk out, you be confident, you take a pause, you look around, then that actually makes the audience go, oh, I trust you, because you're really happy to be there. And it's so much about reading people and how they read you, and all of it becomes kind of weirdly natural
That's a key sign to make it look as though, A, it's your first time and easy to do. That's a gift. And you gain that with experience. My next question is, what is your best and worst comedy gig? And I think you all have to have bad gigs to make you a better comedian.
Yeah, the worst thing with this is that I find it really hard to remember the best gig, but I can tell you so many worst gigs.
I'm a big fan. That's all I can say.
At least I've got one. I think I was trying to think about best gigs. So I'll start with that, because there's only really, there's loads that I loved doing, but there was one that was so exciting. I still think about it, and I can't remember the year now, so this is terrible, but I think it was 2011. And it was at the time when there were going to be, the first time of many, sadly, when there were going to be lots of cuts to the NHS, right? And and Josie Long and Daniel Kitson and a few people like that put together this gig. Actually, no, it wasn't Kitson, sorry, it was Josie and Mark Thomas.
Right.
And oh, they brilliant. Put together this gig on Westminster Bridge as part of it. There was a big protest to save the NHS. Yeah. Then again, it obviously didn't work, sadly. but it was this big protest, and part of it was blocking off Westminster Bridge. And they made a stage on the bridge, and Josie performed and Mark performed, and there were over 1,000 people crowded around us, and the energy was just crazy. And I remember before I went on, I knew I was doing a set, and I was really excited, very very nervous, because I'd not really done a sort of thing at, like, you know, outside of a gig before. This was a proper in the middle of a demonstration, and it really felt like it meant something, because it was really, this is for an important cause that we care about. And there was in the audience, I saw before I went on, was Kevin Eldon, who I hugely admire. But also, he was with, he introduced me, and I'd met him a bit before, and he said, oh, how are you doing? And he said, this is my friend Chris. And he was with Chris Morris from Grassline. He was like a hero of mine. But I was like, oh no, I didn't know you'd be there. It was terrifying. And I mentioned Kitson because Kitson was in the audience, and he said, oh, I wouldn't do this. This terrifies me. And I was like, oh my God, you wouldn't do this. But I remember Josie's special. I remember Mark hosting it brilliantly. And then I did a set, and it just was that lovely thing of people obviously were very not politically on board because they were there, but they laughed. They laughed so loud because I think it was this mutual feeling of this is awful, but we're all connected and we all, you know, we all want something to happen here, but we can all laugh about it as well. Yeah, we can all, you know, laugh at the horrors of things. And I just remember the rush from that gig. Stayed with me, but it felt really important and amazing to do something like that. So I just remembered it for a very long time afterwards. Yeah,
Watson is a Mark Watson is such a encouraging force for either any comic or any audience member for the things that he does. I'd love to interview him here. I've been to so many of his 24-hour shows and Watsathons and everything, and I know you're on those quite a bit, and he always manages to make you do horrible things. I can't think why.
That's the thing, is like I'll probably mention one of them later, but like the things that I did in those shows were really memorable and genuinely some of the best things, but they're also like not gigs, if that's how, because they're not like I never do a stand-up set. I just get hit in the face with a rotten fish or something, or I have to, like, you know, sit in ice cold water after, you know, so it's always like, to me, it is performing, but it's not, I never really know if it's a stand-up gig. It's like a sort of event, it's like a happening
or anything like that. No.
So it's, I never know how to class it. Like, they're really important things that have happened, and I love them. I never know if I can put that up there with, like, say, you know, I got to do a gig with Frankie Boyle and Jen, and Francesca Martinez at St David's Hall in Cardiff, so about 2,500 people. Wow. And like, that's a gig.
Yeah,
and then we being at Mark Watson's thing, we'll have to eat a cup of flour. Is like, it's not, it's a different skill set.
It's still for your CV, I think.
definitely. Yeah, it's very true.
I spend my holiday every year going to the Edinburgh Fringe. I go up there for a week and I see over 50 shows. The majority of them are comedians. And by the time I come back, I need another holiday because I'm exhausted from laughing.
I bet you do, yeah.
But I love it. What was your Edinburgh Fringe first? What was your first one like? Can you describe your experience?
Yeah, absolutely. I realise that I've got out of telling you my worst gig, but I don't mind.
Please tell me your worst gig before that, please.
I forgot to remember it. Well, it depends on if you want. I'm also happy to ignore it. It haunts me every day. I'll do it very quickly.
That's fine.
But, and again, this is one of about 15 I could mention, but this one in particular, it's difficult to know which one. There was one at Blackwood Miners Institute in Wales,
brilliant,
where I was introduced by James Cook, who's a fantastic compere, but they didn't even applaud me as I walked on.
No.
And then I walked on, and for 30 minutes, they were completely silent. And I tried talking to them, I tried telling jokes, I tried doing stories, nothing worked.
Wow.
And I walked off to complete silence. And then there was an interval, and then James Cook went back on, and they were very, like, lovely and applauding, and then Mark Olver went on and stormed it, and that was terrible.
Wow. So,
I had no idea what I hated myself about
that.
It was weird, horrible.
What is it? What have I said? I was funny.
I just had my time. And that's, I put that top. That actually, just under that is the one where I asked a man to start the applause and he refused. And I kept having a go at him until I realized he only had one hand. So, you know, you end up with all these.
Oh, mate. But you've powered on. You've carried on. That's the magic thing. Tell me about your first Edinburgh Fringe experience then, please.
I wasn't doing a show. I was going up to see what it was like, really, and do spots on other people's shows, like a lot of people do. And so it would be 2005.
Right. And same year as me, my first one.
Right, which was a great year. There was a lot of good stuff going on then. And I definitely remember going to see, I think Jerry's Long was doing a show with Dan Nightingale that was brilliant.
Yeah.
I remember going to see Bill Bailey in a play, I think, with Dave Jones, and I can't remember. And I went to a lot of the late night shows. I did a spot at Spank and stuff. But
right.
I mean, mainly, I'll be honest, I was drunk solidly for that. I don't think I slept a wink. And I had a horrible experience where I was staying in a hostel for the beginning bit, and then I was going to stay on my friend and then agent sofa, Brett Vincent, brilliant Brett Vincent.
Oh, he's brilliant. And,
but I couldn't stay until halfway through the week, so I stayed in the hostel. And I got woken up. Like, I think I'd been out all night long in the loft bar and everywhere else until the early hours. And then we'd gone to like the Penny Black in the morning, the first drinks at like 6 a.m.
Good lad.
It's so grim thinking about it now. That place is a stunk of like just air. And I remember I'd gone to bed, and then about 5 minutes later, there was banging on the door of the hostel going, "You have to get out. This is what you're meant to have checked out this morning."
Oh, no.
And I had 5 minutes sleep, and I was shivering, and Brett was asleep because it was the early, it was like 7 a.m. So I was calling him, he wouldn't pick up.
Oh,
and I had to sit in, what's that pub on Cowgate where they do the karaoke? Yeah, Bannerman's, is it Bannerman's?
Bannerman's, yeah.
Yeah, and I sat in there shivering for like 4 hours drinking coffee.
Yeah.
Until Brett came and collected me.
good lad. The just to confirm, I think the Bill Bailey show was the one I saw. They did The Odd Couple, and it was him and Alan Davis.
Yes.
They were really well cast. I remember it was brilliant. Bill Bailey was Oscar the Grouch.
Yes.
Alan Davis was Felix the Pernickety Plum.
Yes.
But it was hammered all the time. That's much better. That's a great story. And I really feel for you that you only had the 5 minutes sleep.
It was just that horrible feeling as well. But I think I just... Yeah, that horrible feeling. You know, when you're not sure if you slept or not. Because you... like.
Brilliant.
All you want was to crawl into a bed. Oh, it was horrible, really horrible. But it was great. I remember being so excited by... I'd never seen anything like it.
The atmosphere is incredible when you step off the train. It just hits you and you think, I'm going to love this.
Have you
been going on a regular basis then to Edinburgh?
Yes and no. I did until about 2011 where... basically financially my show did all right, but financially it did terribly,
right,
and I had to take a couple of years off to try and claw some of that money back. Which was actually amazing. Like, I suddenly realized how much work there was outside the fridge. I got a part in Fresh Meat on Channel 4's and I did loads of gigs, and I had got an advert that filmed in Cyprus and all these sorts of other work, and I went, oh my god, I've earned money in the summer, this is weird. And then I went back for a few years, and then I became a dad, and I haven't been back since because I can't. It was the first 2 years I didn't get a single night of sleep, full night of sleep, and I couldn't figure out how to write a show on without having had any sleep. I couldn't do it.
Oh,
it's harder to justify spending all the money to be there when you also have to feed a kid. So. But hey, if and when it comes back, I'm planning to go whenever it returns.
So.
Yeah.
Maybe not this year, but next year, hopefully.
I think so, yeah.
That's what a lot of comedians say, though. They tell me that they say that you go up for the exposure, but it costs such a lot, unfortunately, for them to put the shows on, because you're doing 25 nights if you're doing the whole thing, I suppose.
Yeah, well, it's so expensive because you're paying for, I mean, accommodation, as you know, you've played up there, accommodation's so expensive, and then you're paying for, I have to pay rent back home and accommodation there, and then you pay for your publicity materials and the brochure entry, and then for your venue, and then for any tech staff, and then for any PR if you've got that, and then to live and eat up there, but you're not getting paid for your gigs, and so that year, 2011, I think I sold a good percentage of tickets, and I lost £7,500.
Oh, mate.
And I can't afford that. So it was a shame. But it's a shame because it's also, you know, like it's not just the being seen. It's the fact that you're there with all your friends. It's the fact that you can experiment and really put an hour
it's
together.
It's one massive party, isn't it? It's incredible because the amount of comedians that you do see, you know, I could go for the entire festival and not get round as many of the acts that I want to see. It's so good that there is a festival like that that does that, you know.
There's the thing as well, is that people get to do shows that they don't get to do the rest of the year round. They get to tell stories or talk about stuff that they can't do in a 20-minute set in a club, that they can't do unless they're already touring. And like creatively, that's so exciting. Creatively being able to see your friends do shows like that and go, oh my god, I didn't know you could do that, or I didn't know you had that story in you, or that you would, you know, that you perform in that way, because I've only seen you do this 20 minutes over the past 3 years or whatever. You know, you get to see a whole different side to performers, and I think that's amazing. I always find it such an inspiration, like,
yeah, really good. What do you think makes a good comedian? Do you think there's a particular thing, or have you ever thought about this? Is it a difficult question?
No, I'm a really picky audience member.
So you want me at every one of them?
I'm terrible. I really can't sit in comedy audiences anymore because I'm overthinking it. I so rarely laugh because I'm always going, oh, that's a good punchline. Or maybe you could have extended that bit. And so I try to stay the back and hide now. But I think, like, this is a personal thing. What I like, and I'm going to contradict it as well in a minute, because it's also, I like other stuff. But what I like is, maybe it's the wrong word, but like an honesty. And I don't mean that they have to be, like, every tale has to be true, but like that they have to be believing in what they're performing, what they're performing. And because I just feel like I can really tell when I see an act and I'm like, that's not what you think. Or, you know, I don't think you really care about this story at all. Or, you know, I don't think you've ever really had this thought, or you're actually bothered by this. And even when it's like a character, there are acts who perform that character and you go, I know this is coming from your brain, that we're like getting a direct route to you. Or even when someone's telling a tale that I know they've elaborated on, I feel like I know when the emotion is them. Do you know what I mean? Like,
I know exactly what you mean. Because you are a comedian yourself, you can tell where every inflection is, where every point is, and you think, no, I think I could do that better.
there's a real difference when you can tell that someone's saying something because they think it'll make the audience laugh, or when someone's saying something because it makes them laugh and it's something they need to tell you, and that it's fizzing in their brain, and you know there's an excitement and an energy to when a comic is. And I say honest because that's probably not the right word. Because as I said, sometimes it's stuff they've made up, but it's like it's just what they want to do, what they really want to tell you, rather than I thought this would work on the telly. You know, there's a real difference.
There is an argument because I've seen so many, as I said at the start, I've seen so many comedians where they think they're funny, and the majority of the audience don't laugh at them, and then they're flawed. Yeah. If you go out and you, as I said at the start, I think original, endearing, or number one, funny with your jokes, you or your stories, you can't go wrong. But if you go out trying to make an audience laugh, it can be seen, I think.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And I think it's one of the things that I think is so interesting, without getting too topical, but there's been this big argument the last few years about things that are cancelled in comedy or things that you can't say. And actually, my belief is, whatever my politics are, comics who are genuine on stage can tell you anything. They can talk about anything at all and win an audience over with it. And some of my favourite gags have been things that I massively disagree with in real life. The comic was told in such a brilliant way. Or like just landed the punchline perfectly, and you just and it will send you into fits and giggles. You know, because I think like with comedy you can break down so many barriers between people, and you can open up people to so many other chains of thought and ideas. If they go right, you're being honest about it. You're just talking to me as you or as the character you really want to be or whatever, you know. But if you've got that energy and you're doing something you really want to do, I think people really sense that and they'll go along with it. And
I totally agree.
You can get away with talking about anything.
How do you cope with any nerves before you go on stage? Do you get nervous?
Do you know what? This is weird because I did, and then I stopped. I stopped getting nervous and absolutely just haven't felt nerves for a long time. And then recently, with comedy disappearing and not doing it very regularly, the few live gigs I've had, I've been absolutely terrified again. And even online gigs, I've had a weird nervousness because I feel like I'm not match fit. I feel like I'm not gig fit anymore. And so I've just had to really like try and remember that I can do it. I think as long as I've got my first line in my head, then I know that I'm going to be all right. If I know where I'm going to start and where I'm going to finish, then I feel like I'm in control. But it's a really weird feeling to get nervous again when and in fact, I was talking to Angela Barnes the other day. We were doing a gig, an online gig together. Fantastic. And she was saying that she was feeling nervous again too.
And it's
so weird because I really felt like I'd just beaten it. I felt like, I think I'd had about nearly 7 or 8 years where I'd just been going on stage going, I don't care anymore. I'm just out there. I don't have any nerves. I can do this, whatever the size of room, whatever the audience. And then since March last year, I've suddenly gone, oh my goodness, this is a little bit scary again. And I'm not, I don't feel full. So I think part of it is just being prepared. Like you've got to, you know, feel like you're on top of your game.
I think as well, I mean, my next couple of questions, how do you cope with difficult audiences and how do you remember all your routines? You need that, without being big-headed, you need someone like me in the audience willing you along to succeed. If you know, that's why I do genuinely laugh. You know, I do find things very, very funny. It's very rare I sit in silence in an audience. It's like, oh, what's the matter with Rich? You know, but because I've seen so many, I totally agree with what you say. You know, it's a daunting thing to do, and it can be terrifying to go back to, but it is all about experience, I think.
Yeah, well, there are times where you just feel, I mean, you know, comics refer to it as being gig fit or match fit. Yeah. It's like, if you do, say, 3 gigs in a row, by the fourth gig that week or even the next week, you just don't, everything's in your head and it's busy and you just walk on stage and you're like, I am top of my game. And that's all you need is a few gigs like that. But especially over the last year where I think from March, I didn't have a gig till August, and then I had 2 in a row, then I didn't have any till October. And these are like just with proper audiences. The audiences were miles away and all spread out. And you never quite feel like... And saying that, as soon as I got on stage, it was fun.
Yeah.
But before stage, you're running through your head going, can I still do this?
Yeah.
Have I still got this? Yeah. Am I going to remember anything? Because I haven't had to for so many months, and I've just been absorbing Netflix instead of...
You and the rest of the world.
So I tell you, that's another fear that I had is, you know, recently it's been going, oh no, am I going to only have the same things to talk about that every other act is going to talk about? Because we've all had exactly the same thing.
Show for every comic.
That's it. We've all been going, oh, who hasn't been dressed in one?
You're nicking my jokes, you know.
That's it.
So, How do you cope with any difficult audiences that you get? Do you have a route? Do you have a set thing to say or to cope, or do you have any difficult audiences?
They've got less and less over the. I think I'm going to credit Al Pitcher with this, the brilliant Al Pitcher, and it might not be his, so I might be giving him credit for something he's never said. But I'm sure it was him that told me when I was like a new act. He said to me about how the better you get, the more like everything becomes slightly easier. So bad audiences become okay audiences. Okay audiences become good audiences. Good audiences become great, because you learn how to manipulate them as an act. And I think that's definitely true. And so, thankfully, in the last few years, I've had a lot less difficult audiences than I've ever had, really. But it's still hard. It's individual. You know, there are just times when you walk into a room and go, there is nothing I can do. There's no way. Like that one in Buckingham's team. I feel that. Yeah. And then there are other times where you go, do you know what? I know the remedy to this. What you need is for me to calm down a bit, or for me to go higher energy, or for me to focus on the people that are enjoying it and pull the rest of the audience with them, or for me to talk to them and make it. I'd say here's a good thing that I definitely do. I think a good thing. How open does that sound? Might not work for everyone. But I did some gigs in Finland a few years ago.
Right.
And I got told that Finnish audiences are really tough because they don't laugh and they don't like laughing. They clap, but it's very silent and they won't really go along with anything. And I was like, okay, are you sure? Because everyone likes to laugh around the world. And what I did is I wrote 5 minutes about them. I wrote 5 minutes about Finnish politics. I wrote 5 minutes about everything I'd seen and done while I was there. And I made it as much about them. And I talked about people in the audience before I did any of my own material, or my normal material. Yeah. And they laughed and laughed and laughed. And then when I talked about me, they carried on laughing. Wow. And I was like, all this is I've got to make you relate to, I've just got to bring you on board with me. And then it's fine. And I've really realized that, like, gigging around the world, or as much as I have gigged around the world, that works every time. That's all I've got to do is go.
What a perfect setup, though. What a great idea to get them involved early on, and then you're away. You can say what you like.
Yeah, well, it's just like, it's really silly things, but like in Bergen in Norway, they've got this is a rubbish joke, and I appreciate it's not going to work. But they've
I'm
got a bank
called,
like, it's spelled like SPARE bank. So I go, you're so rich over here, you've got a spare bank. And they always love that. You know, it's just like little things that are about them that you go, this is only for you. And then they're on board, and then you can tell them anything else. And I just feel like that's, even with hard audiences over here, unless they're so loud that they can't even hear you, you know.
That's me out then.
That's it. You're the worst, bitch. The worst of that. We're chanting and beer shaking.
How do you remember your routines? Have you got a way of remembering them?
I'm sort of unknowingly good with memory when it's stuff that I've written myself. So I was quite good at, like, when I do acting, quite good at learning lines and getting it in my head, often through repetition. But I find that if I've written it myself, it's sort of often in my head anyway. And then, again, like I said to you before, as long as I've got the beginning and the end in my head, then the rest of it sort of comes back. I don't know. It's really weird. It's sort of annoyingly there. This has gone lately because with gigs online, I have little notes in the corner of my screen.
Don't tell them that.
So it's totally cheating. Yeah.
Well, I've seen a lot of comedians who have notebooks if they've got new material nights or on the hands or whatever, or they've got pointers as they're going along. Other than the blog, my one of the greatest creative things I did, I wrote a half-hour play. I wanted it for the Edinburgh Festival, which I still might put it on, but I raised a lot of money for Comic Relief with it, and it's called The Applicant. It's basically about a chap who never gets a job, but he goes for a lot of interviews. So the audience, as he's nervously waiting for his job, for the job interview, he chats to the audience. So it's monologue, then interview with the interviewer, then monologue. And I learnt this. And the first night I walked out, I had to do a 6-page monologue, and I forgot it. And I was like a rabbit in headlights. And as soon as my mate came on and we chatted, it brought it back. But I've never been so scared in my life. I thought,
that's terrifying.
Weeks we've rehearsed doing this and for this.
That's it. But yeah, a big part of it is about being like relaxed as well. Because it seems intense, and worry about not remembering it. You start to not remember it.
I learned a lot. Yeah, I learned a lot from it. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh my God. But also, that's a lot to remember. Like six.
I didn't realize till I wrote it.
Yeah. But presumably as well, I mean, it depends on, I don't know how you wrote it, but like, it's about putting the beats in as well. So you almost sort of can remember to the next bit. I mean, I don't know how Like, I always look at acts like Milton Jones that are all one-liners, and I have no idea. I have no idea how he remembers that, because that's beyond me.
The only thing I can think of is he must have something like Bob Monkhouse's joke books where there's a subject and he'll go, right, yes, there. And he's got about 100 on the go.
I think that's it. Yeah, you sort of categorise it.
But again, I'm in awe of you all remembering it all, and that's why I like to ask the question. To date, what has been your comedy highlight, my friend?
Can I cheat and do two quick ones?
Yeah.
Yeah, because I've got two.
Yeah.
One is that I got to gig with Robin Williams.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. I that was at Math Brown's Outside the Box gig in Kingston.
Wow.
And I was going to go in first, and then Zoe Lyons had to go in first because she had to get home to Brighton. Right. And so Math said, do you mind going on after the middle bit? And I was like, no, that's fine, right? And the middle bit was already quite scary because it was Al Murray and Omid Jalili.
Wow.
And I was like, well, okay, that's quite hard to follow them. And they said there's a special guest as well. I was like, oh, okay, cool. And then Al Murray went on, smashed it. Omid Jalili went on, smashed it. And then while we were backstage, the door opened, four like bodyguards all in black walked in.
Wow.
And then they walked in, and then Robin Williams walked in, and we were going, hang on, is that? And then he walked around and shook everyone's hand and talked to us all, was so lovely.
Oh,
and he came up to me and I was like, oh, I'm Robin Williams. He's like, hey, great to meet you. And I was like, I think I've got to follow you on stage.
Wow.
And he was like, yeah, that's okay. And he said, I remember I once had to follow a big comedian on stage in New York, and he was really famous at the time and I wasn't. And I died on my ass. And it was fine. Oh my God.
That is brilliant.
And then I remember Matt walked on stage after Omid and said to the audience, all right, and now please give up for Robin Williams. The audience went, hey. And he
deafening.
Did 15 minutes and
that
just blew the place away. And then I had to go on stage afterwards. It was a brilliant gig because the audience was so energized.
What an accolade, though.
Yeah.
Brilliant. I remember when I first came to London, I've been in London 25 years, when I first came, he used to do secret comedy store gigs, but I've never heard him play anywhere else. And I would have loved to have been there. I did manage to get to see Bill Hicks, who was incredible. And Robin Williams, the energy of the comic was just extraordinary. And he could take one tiny thing and just explode with it.
He was doing a thing for Prince Charles's 60th birthday or something. And so he'd done sort of five gigs that week in and around, like little gigs around London. But it was, none of his knew it was going to be, because they had to keep it so top secret.
Wow.
It was genuine. And as I said, that wonderful thing of the audience, I was really scared, but the audience was so energized so like shocked that they'd seen him, that I had like the loveliest gig because they were so full of energy.
Oh, I bet that was amazing.
It was great. So pretty incredible. And then the other one, the other one, I got to gig in Iceland, which was amazing. But we did a gig that was like way out of town, like way far away from Reykjavik. And I remember complaining at times. So I was like, this is a big hall, but there's only a handful of people there. And the promoter was like, no, half the town have come to see you. And it was amazing.
Wow.
The gig was incredible. But this is the bit. On the drive home, we pulled over and the Northern Lights happened in the sky.
Oh, mate.
And I got to stand and watch the Northern. I did this gig to like half of the town and then went and then saw the Northern Lights.
How fantastic is that?
And
what
that was
a highlight.
Unbelievable. So that's it.
That's fantastic. That really is. What a great story. What ambitions, if any, do you have to have being a comedian? Do you have any ambitions? Do you want your own show on a Saturday night? Do you want to play the O2? Have you got any ambition, or are you just happy to do what you wonderfully do?
I don't know. Like, currently, it's like, I'd just like to do a gig again, please.
Everybody surprisingly said that, unfortunately,
I don't know. I like to, do you know what? It's a bit of a wishy-washy one, but I'd like to continue doing work that I enjoy.
Yeah.
So I think I've been, pre-corona kicking off, I was finally at a point where I was only doing work that I really, really liked. So my year, this is going to be heartbreaking, I'll tell you this. Before the coronavirus kicked off, my year for last year was going to be supporting Frankie Boyle until October. three or four nights a week, which I love. I love Frankie and I love doing those films. And I get to do material I like about politics and things. And then I was going to be working with this charity called Nesta, writing all their podcasts and hosting more about different technologies. And it was all stuff that I got excited by. And then I had all the kids stuff as well. And I was touring a kids show about politics that I was enjoying. There was comedy. And so it was all, I just want to do work I really enjoy doing.
That's brilliant. That's fantastic Really good answer. Moving on from that, we're all living in strange times. It's horrible time for everybody. How have you found online gigs as opposed to live gigs? Have you done many?
Do you think? I'm getting used to it. I've got used to it, I think, but it's weird, and I miss feedback from audience. I mean, it's nice getting feedback afterwards, but like I did a gig on Thursday for it was a corporate gig for a company. For their well-being week, and I did 30 minutes and they were all on mute, and so I'm just it's a bit like your play. I was just doing a monologue really. And they were lovely, and I got lovely messages afterwards, but I still come away, I haven't quite got the adrenaline rush, I can't quite go off on a tangent because I can't really talk to them. So I miss live gigs a lot, but I feel like, you know, there are lots of positives to it in that we probably should have all been doing online gigs for a long time. And there's lots of people I know who've got mobility issues and saying, finally, I can watch comedy now. Finally, I can get to the gigs I couldn't travel to. And we're all getting to see comedians we couldn't see in our own homes. And that's quite exciting. So I think we need to come away from this and still do some of it. But I miss it. It's not the same, is it? I miss it.
It's a fantastic substitute, but you can't beat live. Because you never know what you're going to get with live. When I go to a lot of online gigs, and I'm not keen on the ones where you're seen in a Zoom chat or whatever, but you can't be heard. Because all I do is convulse and laugh at these four walls. And who has that? I have neighbours knocking on windows.
It's a shame that your laughter can't go anywhere. We can't hear it, and it makes timing weird as well. Like, I've really noticed, like, I'm almost too fast because I can't hear the laughs to slow me down or to put the pauses in where I need to. I just think it's a very tricky thing. And also, do you know the other thing? This is a big thing that is a big difference. Like, I used to complain about long drives to gigs, but actually, in those drives, I'd be thinking about my material and I'd think about other bits I could add on. I'd get into the mindset. And now I'm like dealing with my daughter having a tantrum downstairs. And then I come upstairs on the computer and go, oh, gig. And I'm like, I haven't got into the headspace at all. Like, you know.
That's brilliant.
It's not the same like mindset.
Who are your comedians, past and present? Favourite comedians, past and present?
Oh, this is so hard because it changes for me every few minutes. But also, like, there's people that, like, I love, and then like there'll be a different week and there'll be something else I'm really into. So, you know, there are people that I've always loved Harry Hill, and I love comedians that are completely bonkers, that are just completely mad. But then Josie is a friend of mine. I love Josie Long, and I love Izzy Sooty when she was gigging. And I currently really, I think Fern Brady's brilliant.
And
I always love Frankie stuff, Frankie Boyle stuff, because I love that he's just brutal with it. And I love Jen Brister. And I got to gig with Angela Barnes and Jess Costigan the other day. It's hard, there's lots. John Mulaney is
I first saw him at the comedy store. I think he was on the first bill I ever saw there. The reason I asked the question is that I've got many memorable comedy nights where I've been. So in the 70s, the first two live acts I saw were Les Dawson and Tommy Cooper.
Took
off from then. The 80s, I saw Rick Mayall, Ben Elton, and they were all starting off French and Saunders. And I thought, I've got something here for the blog, and hence the blog and everything. But talking of Harry Hill, he still holds the greatest opening line I've ever heard to a set. I saw him, and I know him quite well through Always Be Comedy. He plays there quite a bit. I've told him this. I first saw him downstairs at the King's Head about 25 years ago, 30 years ago. And he brushed past me, jumped onto the stage, and he said, "Ladies and gentlemen, I'm really sorry I'm late today. I had to have a testicle brought down." And there was a pause so the audience could laugh. And then he said, "From Derby." And I said this to him, and he went, "Yes, I still use that opening line."
He's so good. Magic. He's just so. I got to see him once at Old Rope, and that's the only time I've met him. I was such an awkward fanboy.
Hilarious. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm quite good when talking to other comedians, so I think we all do the same job. But with him, I went backstage to say hello, and I was so nervous.
I was exactly the same. He was the first one I met. There was him, and on the same bill was Nick Helm. And I'd seen Nick Helm once before. And of course, he was aggressive because I didn't know who Nick Helm was. He's a very good friend of mine now. But the aggression when he followed Harry Hill to me was hilarious.
Yeah, I bet. That's an amazing pairing.
Is this guy for real? And yeah, he is. It's just an act.
That lovely thing of, I think the thing that I'm still like, again, what I'm really missing right now is the fact that comedians of all, like, no matter how long you've been going, they all still gig.
Yeah.
And
you
still meet all your heroes and all the people that you admire. Yeah. Like, I pretty much met, here's a little story, but when I was at university, in my first year of university, Ed Byrne played the Bilbenkian in Canterbury, and we went to go see him, and he was so funny, but also afterwards, we all lined up and he signed the postcards for his tour for us. And I remember he wrote to me, "To Tin," and as in Tommy, the Perrier Award winning bastard, right? And I did that on my work, right? And then a bit later on in university, when I was doing stand-up, I wrote to some of the comedians I liked asking for advice, and I wrote to Dave Gorman, who wrote me a lovely email, because I was watching him on the telly at the time with Are You Dave Gorman. He wrote me this lovely email that was very encouraging about do what you like and do what you enjoy.
Yeah.
And it made my day. And then it was about 10 years later, I was running a club in Islington called Fat Tuesday, where I used to get acts down I liked, and the bill was me, Stuart Goldsmith, Dave Gorman, and Ed Byrne. And I was
that's brilliant.
I never stayed with the people that were like, you know, direct influences to me
that
just 10
so
years ago.
Good.
That's mad, isn't it?
Yeah, like, it's brilliant. It's so good. That's a great story. Like me, do you go to many comedy nights as a member of the audience?
No.
I think I'm going to drop this question because every comedian I've talked to said no.
It's not because I don't want to. I think it's partly now as a dad, I just don't have the time. But it's also like, it's really hard to justify when you're gigging so many nights a week to then choose the night you're not to go and see comedy. It's hard. So I just try and... unless it's somebody that I've really worked with a lot, I try and stick around at gigs to watch the others if I can.
Yeah.
But even then, often you've got to get home. It's quite hard.
But
I really miss it. Like, I miss sitting in audiences. I miss, as I mentioned earlier, I'm a grumpy audience member because I sit, not grumpy, but my brain's like thinking.
Self-analytical.
That's it. But I do miss it. Like, I ran with Tim Stevenson quite some years ago called the Phoenix Fringe, which was a sort of Edinburgh alternative in London.
Yeah.
And because I was co-running it, I would help out on all the nights, even when I wasn't doing a show. And I just loved sitting in the back and going, I'm getting to watch all these shows. Like, I've got an excuse to do it. It was brilliant, you know.
There's nothing I love more than going out on a Saturday night to somewhere like Headliners or the Soho Theatre or something, and you really make a night of it. You have a few beers before you go in. It's open till 2-3 a.m. But the show in the middle is just the thing that you're there for. And I so wish it would come back. So because I miss it so much, but even I can't go to comedy every single night. I do get tired.
you do a lot better than a lot of people, I think. Yeah, you do a lot better. There's also a thing, and actually online gigs have been good for this. Like, I'm very positive about a lot of comedians I work with, but I find that a lot of comedy on telly is edited in a way that makes me dislike acts that I like, even acts that I like. You know,
very
sort of watch them on telly and go, I'm not enjoying this in the same way I would do if I... So I don't watch much comedy on telly at all.
No, I think that's a very good point. Yeah, very good point. TB, I think, has to be watered down for the mass audience, and I don't agree with that. I think you need to see comedians live so they can say their point of view.
Well, it's not just that; it's also that they have to edit it to certain timings to fit certain, so it's quick. And they, you know, they'll take a 20-minute set and make it 10 minutes, and also it's edited by. And I've got a lot of respect for people who edit, and editors, a good friend of mine's an editor, but they're not comedians. They don't have the same timing and they don't know the gags where they land, and key bits are missed out, or key inflections and tangents. And often I'll, you know, if I haven't been to a live gig for ages, I sort of think, oh, comedy's rubbish at the moment, so I just think, I'm coming. And then I'm live and go, oh, no, it's brilliant. I'm really excited about it. And I almost need the live stuff to remind me that people are doing exciting things and exciting stuff's happening.
It is. It's so true what you say. We're nearly coming to the end of it. Apart from, is there anything else you would like to say? Please tell me about any podcasts, any writing, any shows you're doing, anything like that.
Cool. We should at the end. This is going to go on for about an hour, Rich.
Go on, please.
No, the main things I do, I mean, and also I have to say, these are not just things I do, these are the things that have been keeping me sort of sane for the last year. I do a weekly podcast called Partly Political Broadcast, which is a politics and comedy podcast, and being able to write every week and put it out and know people are listening to it has genuinely kept me like, oh, I've got something to do, and it's given me a reason to
do
stuff.
It's like me with this. It keeps me
going. It's necessary. And also the audience that listen to it have been so lovely and genuinely donated, and that money has kept me alive without gigs, and I've been very grateful for that. But also I'm getting to talk to people who are experts in issues, and I'm learning stuff from it every week, and I'm finding that's very useful. And I mean, even just, you know, the beginning of this year, I spoke to an expert in European law who broke down the Brexit deal, and I went, oh, actually, I'm not as panicked by everything now that you've made it all make sense. This is great, and that's really reassuring.
Very
I need that. And then on the other side, we're also doing a regular comedy club for kids podcast called Radio Nonsense, where I just talk. I get kids to send in questions, and then I ask comedians to answer them. So the first week was Stu Goldsmith, who had to answer, why are there no more flying pigs? Abigail Shimon had to answer, why do kids
find
pigs
funny?
Yeah, it's great. The one that will go out next week is the noise next door have had to answer. And a kid told me, he put this in brackets, say this in an Italian accent. I had to ask them, who stole my meatballs? And they had to answer. So I love it. It's great. That's maybe a nonsense.
My best noise next door story. I see them every year at the Edinburgh Fringe, and we absolutely love them.
They're wonderful.
And I go back to Carlisle whenever I can. About what, a year ago, 18 months ago, I very sadly lost my mum, and I was really low and all the rest of it. My brother said to me, he said, go to the comedy. And the Noise Next Door were playing Carlisle. And I went in, little tiny club, and I sat at the back feeling very low with a pint of beer in my hand, and they bounded on and they said, can anybody tell me what's good about Carlisle? And somebody yelled out Carlisle United. And then they said, can anybody tell me what's bad about Carlisle? And a mate of mine was in the crowd and went, Richard Gill. And they went, oh my God, is he? He's in London. What's he doing here? And I'm like, cheers.
Oh, that's
so
nice.
I was the butt of the joke for the rest of the night. And it really cheered me up. And
I was going to say, though, what a great way to pick you up and you know,
oh, yeah. And that's the magic. That's why I love it. You know, we all have tough times and everything, especially now. But to enable to do this, especially online and especially live, is just fantastic. I am amazed that we've never actually physically met. I've only known you online, so I'm delighted to see you live very soon when we get back to normal, And I just want to say thank you so, so much. I've thoroughly enjoyed chatting to you. Thanks for having me.
This has been lovely. It's been a nice reason to remember some lovely gigs as well.
Well, my friend, it's been so good. You take care and all the best to you. Thank you so much.
Take care. Lovely to speak to you, Rich.
Thank you.